Jennifer Francis is a research professor at the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University in New Jersey. She's an atmospheric scientist who specializes in the Arctic. Dr. Francis has published many papers, and don't miss her important presentation on YouTube from the Weather and Climate Summit held at Breckenridge, Colorado in January 2012. The New York Times has also interviewed her about a new theory: melting Arctic sea ice could change our weather further south. Dr. Francis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, a new record Arctic sea ice melt is occurring already in August 2012, with more to come in September. To me, this may be the single largest impact of human activity on the planet. It's hard to exaggerate how big this story is, don't you think?
You know, I do think it's hard to exaggerate, because it is such a remarkable event to have reached a record minimum in the ice extent at this early date in the season. Normally, we don't reach the minimum until the middle of September. So, as you mentioned, we still have a couple of weeks left of the melt season, and so we expect there to be quite a bit more melting going on, which means that the old record is going to be positively shattered. And it is also remarkable because it's such a visual event. People can look at a satellite image and really get a sense for just how huge this change to the climate system really is.
Right. It looks like the last of the Arctic ice is kind of hovering around that large chain of islands in the Canadian Arctic, and the entire west side of the Arctic Ocean looks open. The fabled Northwest Passage is open. The sea ice has melted away from the entire Russian coast. Would you change or add to that description?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and that's what's so obvious in the satellite imagery. And the only reason it's left in that area north of Canada all along that coast there is because that's where the thickest ice has existed as far back as we can see, and it will just take a little longer for it to melt there, but ultimately it probably will melt there too in the summer, in not the too distant future.
And it looks like a small space when we look at it from space, but if you're on a ship in the Arctic, it must be a vast area we're talking about.
It is, and the ice that exists that's left in the Arctic is much thinner than it used to be. It's much more broken up. It was described yesterday by one of my colleagues as being slushy, like a big slushy, and I think that's a very good way to describe what we have left up there. So because it's so thin and because it's broken means that it's now much more vulnerable to any abnormalities in either the winds or the ocean currents that might come along that, if it had happened 30 years ago, would have had no impact whatsoever.
Back in 2005, you joined a group of scientists in a paper predicting the Arctic would be ice-free eventually in summer. And when that massive ice melt in 2007 struck, we wondered maybe that's a freak event. What are scientists predicting now?
I think just about everyone who is truly involved in any kind of Arctic climate work or Arctic meteorological work believes that it won't be very long before we see a summer Arctic with little or no ice at all in it anymore. And, you know, the dates range from anything from one decade from now to 5 decades from now, but certainly within most of our lifetimes. And that's going to be a remarkable event.
Jennifer Francis, let's go with your presentation at the Weather and Climate Summit last January. You gave us a theory of how this record summer sea ice melt could already be changing our climate. So can you explain that for us? And please take as long as you want.
Sure. So actually, I wouldn't call it a theory so much as observations that support the idea that the Arctic warming and the enhanced Arctic warming is affecting the circulation in the atmosphere. And what we see is that the Arctic is warming about twice as fast as the rest of the hemisphere or the rest of the globe. It's warming faster than anywhere else on the planet, except possibly for the peninsula of the Antarctic. And that's just a very small region. Now, we have to understand what drives weather systems in the northern hemisphere, and that is this phenomenon we call the jet stream. The jet stream you can think of as a river of fast-moving air that's high above our heads, and it pretty much encircles the hemisphere, and it typically has waves in it, very similar to a river, but these waves go north and south as the jet stream encircles the northern hemisphere. What drives this jet stream is the difference in temperature between the warm tropics and the mid-latitudes and the colder Arctic. The larger this temperature difference is, the stronger the jet stream is. So in the old days, or when the ice was thick up there and the Arctic was much colder than it has been lately, this difference in temperature has been large, and so the jet stream has been stronger in the west to east part of its winds. As we warm the Arctic faster than the rest of the northern hemisphere, that means this difference in temperature is getting smaller. And what we see as a result of that is that the jet stream winds in the west to east direction are getting weaker, just as we would expect to see knowing that the Arctic's getting warmer faster. And not only that, but these waves in the jet stream that I mentioned, if you warm the northern tips of these waves more than you do the rest of the wave, it tends to stretch those peaks in the waves farther northward. And what this does is it makes those waves larger in the north-south direction. So you can picture looking down from a satellite at the United States, and you would see the waves actually extending farther northward in as they go through their swings north and south around the planet. Now, what this means is that both of these factors together, the weakened jet stream and also the larger waves, both have the same end result, and that is to make these waves in the jet stream move more slowly from west to east. Now, why does that matter? Well, any meteorologist will tell you that when the waves in the jet stream are larger, which happens naturally, we see sometimes they're large and sometimes they're small, but when they're large, we know that the weather systems associated with those waves also move more slowly. So what does that mean? That means that the weather conditions that are occurring at any given point around the northern hemisphere associated with these waves are going to last longer. It's going to feel like your weather is stuck in a particular set of conditions. So if you happen to be in a dry part of the weather pattern, then that dryness is going to continue longer. If you're in a rainy pattern, it'll stay rainy longer. And we can think of some examples of that over the last couple of years, in particular, where a couple winters ago, not this past winter, but the two winters before that, we had very cold, snowy winters in the East Coast of the United States that just seemed to go on forever. And the winter after that, we had just the opposite. We had a very mild, dry winter. And both of those were associated with weather patterns that just were very slow to change. We've seen the same kinds of things happening in Europe, in Alaska. You know, the same concept is that whatever weather you've got just tends to stick around longer. And this, we believe, is at least partly tied to the warming in the Arctic being stronger or larger warming than it is in the rest of the hemisphere, causing these waves to move more slowly.
And how much is this being accepted by other scientists? Is there criticism? Is there support?
Well, in our paper, we showed actual observations that this was indeed occurring. When you have observations, it wasn't just a model predicting this was going to happen in the future. So when you show observations of an event like this or a behavior, people tend to be more accepting. And I think, you know, on the whole, I'd say most scientists I know are at least receptive to the idea. And as we go forward, I know there's a lot of people that have jumped on this idea and they're looking into it further, and as am I. And so I think we'll find further evidence that this is indeed occurring. Other research is using models to look forward in time and see whether this sort of behavior will continue or maybe even become even more enhanced as we continue to add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere and as we continue to see sea ice disappear in the Arctic.
Well, I think listeners in the UK, where the weather was just so wet and it seemed like it would never end, or maybe even in Eastern Europe a couple of years ago when it was so cold and it seemed like it would never go away, or the drought this year in the American Midwest, this starts to make sense in terms of the Arctic sea ice melt could be part of that.
I should mention that in the summertime, the extreme weather that we get in the summer is actually probably not directly linked to the sea ice. I think it's actually directly linked more to the rapid decrease in the amount of snow cover on high-latitude land. Over the last couple of decades, while the sea ice has been melting, we've also been observing that the snow has been melting ever earlier from high-latitude land areas. And this has a very similar effect as the sea ice does, but in a different season, of course. And what happens is when you remove the snow earlier, you expose the soil to the strong spring sunshine earlier, which allows that soil to warm up earlier. And so you end up with the same situation that I described for the sea ice, where you're enhancing the temperatures at high latitudes in the Arctic more than lower latitudes. So the same thing's happening. You're reducing this temperature difference, which also weakens the jet stream and I think is playing a role in the drought that we had this year in the U.S., heat waves, and other summer types of extreme weather.
And we've also heard warnings that retreating ice means a change in the salt content of the sea, which could produce more climate changes, perhaps if the Gulf Stream warming New England or Northern Europe weakens. Have you looked into that? Is it a serious possibility? And if so, how might that develop?
I have not looked into that myself particularly, but I do know that the changes in the ocean circulation have a much longer time period associated with them. It takes a long time for an ocean current like the Gulf Stream to change. And while we may be adding fresh water to the Arctic Ocean, a lot of that fresh water that has been added because of ice melting and actually also from increased river runoff from rivers that flow into the Arctic Ocean, most of that fresh water actually ends up hugging the coast as it exits the Arctic Ocean because of the circulation patterns in the ocean currents. And so it ends up not affecting a very large area. So my feeling is that if there's an impact, it's going to take a long time for it to show up, and it will probably be a relatively small area that's affected.
This is Radio EcoShock with Rutgers atmospheric scientist, Dr. Jennifer Francis. Dr. Francis, shipping has already started through the Arctic Ocean. Oil companies want to drill it. Fishing fleets expect a new harvest. Is it possible the economic benefits of the open Arctic might outweigh the climate changes that we've discussed?
I personally believe that they will not. The extreme weather that I've just been talking about affects millions upon millions, in fact, billions of people, because we're talking about the population that lives in the Northern Hemisphere, which is, you know, a large fraction of the Earth's population, whereas the benefits of shipping and oil exploration up in the Arctic, while it will add to our energy independence, which is a good thing, I don't see that the economic benefits are going to trickle down to affect enough people to offset the detrimental effects of large-scale climate change.
Well, this critical link between what is happening in the Arctic and really the climate of the world could wake up the public. And I'm wondering if there's a way that we can further bolster these observations. What science still needs to be done?
Well, there's a lot of science yet to be done. We have these wonderful tools that we generally refer to as the models or the climate models. They do a remarkable job of simulating how the climate system works, but they're not perfect, and especially given the fact that we're entering new territory, if you will. The climate system is doing things that we've never seen before, things like new record minimum ice extents, for example. And so some of the mathematics in these models that simulate the climate system, which were developed for a world that we knew over the last few decades, may not be exactly right for the world that we're heading into. So there's a lot of research still to be done to perfect the models, and I believe they're doing a remarkable job, but there are things that could be better, and some of those details will be very important going forward in understanding how the changes in the climate system are going to be felt in different parts of the world. And I feel that's very important, because what we really need to focus on now is how people are going to be affected, how we can help mitigate some of those effects so that, you know, less damage is done and people don't suffer any more than they already will. So there's plenty to be done, and we're always looking for smart young minds to bring us new ideas, and there's plenty of room for people to get involved in that research.
Well, frankly, on a personal level, the news about this year's record melt of the summer sea ice leaves me with a sense of worry, if not horror. What are Arctic specialists like yourself feeling about this?
Well, I have to admit that I share that feeling. As the indicators that we're seeing, not just, you know, the Arctic sea ice, but in the snow melt that I mentioned, it's a very robust signal. The increases in extreme weather, the heavy rains that have been recorded that have, you know, never been recorded before in some places, all of these things are falling into line with what the models and what scientists have been saying are likely to happen as we continue to increase the amount of heat-trapping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. It gives me a sense of deep concern. I mean, I have two children, and I worry about the world that they're inheriting. I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this kind of extreme weather, and I think it's going to be a tough problem to turn around. I personally don't think that we're going to be able to decrease the emissions of greenhouse gases enough in this foreseeable future to make a big difference. And so I think we're going to have to focus, as I mentioned earlier, on more on understanding where the impacts are going to be felt so that we can help those people and those habitats and the agricultural systems and everything that's going to be affected to minimize those impacts. So it's a very serious situation, and it boggles my mind that people aren't seeing some of these changes before their very eyes and not believing that human activities aren't playing a role there.
Right. To be able to deny something like the whole poles are melting, you have to really blind yourself to be able to do that. And it's interesting, you talked to the Weather and Climate Summit, and just this August, the American Meteorological Society came out with a much stronger statement that they acknowledge climate science and that the world is warming and so on. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I, in fact, just read it this morning, as a matter of fact. Yes, it's a lot stronger than the previous one, and I think it's very well-timed, and I'm 100% behind the statement.
Well, maybe that's some good news. We could certainly use more TV weather people telling us why these changes are happening. You've been listening to Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University on Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Find links to her site and her fascinating YouTube lecture at the 2012 Weather and Climate Summit in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you, Dr. Francis, for this valuable time together.
You are very welcome, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have at any time.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.